This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, it's more than just punching supervillains. Superhero stories can have a political message. We'll hear more from the creators of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. First, the federal government issued hundreds of billions of dollars in disaster loans to help small businesses during the pandemic. After some delays, those bills are starting to come due. In a new piece for the Wall Street Journal, our next guest found that some businesses are struggling to start repaying those loans, saying their business is still down at the same time as things like inflation and interest rates are high. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you run a business, did you take out one of these federal disaster loans during the pandemic? What did it mean for your business at the time? How is paying it back going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth Simon is a senior special writer who covers small business and entrepreneurship for the Wall Street Journal. Ruth, welcome back to the show.
Nice to speak with you today.
Now, there were different ways that the federal government tried to help businesses get through the worst stages of the pandemic. Your piece focuses on these disaster loans. Can you remind us how those work?
Sure. These are different. Lots of people know about the federal paycheck protection program loans, which were designed to be forgiven if you met certain requirements. This is a different program. These are disaster loans. They have a 30-year term and a low fixed rate, but they are designed to be paid back. And now those bills are starting to come due.
Right, those PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program loans, they got a lot more attention, I think. I don't know if they're more widely used. How widely used were these disaster loans?
A lot of businesses and nonprofits did receive these loans. The SBA issued roughly $390 billion with a B of these COVID disaster loans to nearly 4 million small businesses and nonprofits. And for many small businesses and nonprofits, it was a key piece of aid.
And you talked to people at some of these businesses. Repayment was deferred at least once or twice, right?
Yes, repayment was deferred. Initially, there was a 12-month deferral. The SBA ultimately extended that to 30 months. The thing you have to know about the deferral was you were still getting charged interest during that deferral period, but the idea was to give small businesses some time to recover before they had to start paying back their loans.
Now, you talked to some business owners who were finding it a stretch, at least to pay back some of the loans. Can you talk about some of the businesses you visited with and what you heard?
Sure. I mean, broadly speaking, I think the issue is things haven't bounced back for all the businesses. It's been an uneven recovery, and many businesses are still dealing with inflation and supply chain challenges. Some businesses, like I talked to someone who had a karate studio and business never came back and he had to shut it down. His loan was not huge, but it is a loan. It has to be repaid. And he is working 3 jobs already. So that's just one example. I also talked to the owner of a cookie shop who has used her money to expand her business, to work on her packaging, to hire a franchise consultant. And she started making payments, but I think she expected to be in a little bit of a better place than she is now.
Now, you mentioned inflation, there's interest rates. Also, some of the people you talk to are having trouble, as many businesses are, finding employees, or at least being able to afford employees at current market rates.
Wages have gone up. Filling positions has been difficult for lots of employers. And the other thing that I'd mention, too, is we have some economic uncertainty now. Some people are seeing, you know, business starting to slow again, or maybe it hasn't bounced back to the levels that they thought it would be or that it was before the pandemic.
Talking to Ruth Simon, who covers small business for The Wall Street Journal, looking at federal COVID emergency loans from a couple years back. Loan payments are starting to come due. Some businesses, that's fine. Others, Ruth finds, having trouble repaying. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to talk to a small business expert here in Wisconsin. Love to hear how your small business, if you run one or work at one, is doing, for better or worse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ruth, is there any hope of, I guess, further deferrals or anything like that for businesses in this position? We took out these loans. Economy, or our part of the economy, didn't bounce back like we were hoping it would. What's next?
So I'd say a couple things. First of all, the SBA said about a third of the borrowers made some payments during the period that their loans were in deferral, which suggests they're in okay financial shape. If you're really struggling, there is a hardship payment option. You have to ask the SBA, and they'll let you make a reduced payment for 6 months. And then you have the option to renew that for another 6 months. When I talk to the SBA, they say they are continuing to look at the issue.
And is there any interest either from the White House or for Congress in tackling this and helping businesses again in this difficult position?
I haven't heard of anything yet. We will see. We don't know how many businesses are going to have trouble making their loan payments. What we saw was that there are more than 2 million loans that repayments begin either in December or January. And I think we need to get a sense of what's happening with those to see what happens next.
And Ruth, this loan is just one part of your small business and entrepreneurship beat. We talked about some of the challenges facing businesses in general. What are you watching for next on the small business front?
I'm really keeping my eye on the economy and what that means for small businesses. What happens in the labor market? Do we have sort of a smoother landing? Do things soften more? And also, how small businesses are faring when it comes to competing with larger companies.
Ruth, thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Ruth Simon, senior special writer who covers small business and entrepreneurship at the Wall Street Journal, with us today to talk about her recent report on why some small businesses are struggling to pay back federal pandemic disaster loans. Up next, we'll zoom in on Wisconsin and how small business is doing here with the head of UW-Eau Claire's Small Business Development Center. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. As you look around your community, have you seen a change in the landscape? Were a lot of your small businesses able to survive the last couple of years? Or has there been a lot of turnover? Maybe the local company replaced by a chain of some sort, or vice versa? Are you going back to local shops, restaurants, nail salons, you name it, as much as you did before the pandemic? Flip things around. If you're a small business owner yourself, and that covers a lot of ground, I know, how are things looking for you? What are some of the challenges? What has gone well over the last couple of years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about small businesses in Wisconsin and how or if they're recovering from the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your business? What have the last few months or the past few years been like for you? How can we do a better job supporting especially local small businesses? Did you use one of the federal disaster relief loans or the Paycheck Protection Plan? How did it all work for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Luke Kempin joins us now, director of the Small Business Development Center at UW-Eau Claire. Luke, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about what your organization does?
Well, the Small Business Development Center has a pretty straightforward mission. Our mission is to go out in the community and help people start and grow their businesses. In Wisconsin, there's 12 SBDC offices located pretty much at each one of the four-year campuses in Wisconsin. So,
now, it's been an unusual few years in the economy. I think that's a huge understatement. What are you seeing? What kind of the things are you seeing as the biggest challenges for different kinds of small businesses here in the state?
Well, I think Ruth did a nice job of kind of alluding to the four things that I'm seeing. I would say that's inflation, the employees, hiring employees and getting and finding employees. Interest rates and supply chain was a big issue, but that seems to be improving quite a bit. But along with that improving, now we have interest rates rising and inflation is still strong. So those are, seems like we're going from one thing to the next. So,
and with, we just talked to Ruth about those pandemic emergency loans hitting businesses hard if they're not ready for it. This could be a challenge for a business at any point. We took out a loan, things didn't go like we were hoping. Is there anything unusual about this in a way?
No, I think that you're right. It could happen even on a regular loan or a situation where, you know, a lot of times you're taking out these loans, you're not sure what's going to happen. Hence, you took out the loan to try to help cover what potentially could happen. And we have clients that have been able to pay back that loan. I just had a client this week reach out to me and said they paid back their entire EIDL loan, economic injury disaster loan, to the SBA. But then I've had other clients saying, is there more deferral? Is there another opportunity to defer these loans? So it's kind of where we're at. It kind of runs the gamut.
All right, let's get into some advice now. In general, if you're talking to somebody who's starting a business or maybe looking at expanding or trying to get through a tough patch and they're saying, all right, we're trying to figure out, should we take out loans? How much should we take out in loans? What do you ask them to consider? I know every case is going to be different, but what kind of things should be going through that person's mind?
Really, what we would recommend be done is that you do a set of financial projections, and that's what we do a lot of out of our UW-Eau Claire SBDC Center. A lot of our work is doing financial projections, and really a financial projection is like a budget. It's preparing a budget for your business. And whether you're a startup or an existing business, if you're looking to take on a new activity or offer a new product or something like that, you really want to run a budget on it or run a set of projections and see what it might look like. And that would be the starting point. If it doesn't work on paper, it's probably not going to work in the real world. And even if it does work on paper, it doesn't mean it's going to work in the real world either. So
I think for a lot of people going into a small business, they might know the subject well. We heard about the karate instructor that Ruth mentioned. He might be really good at karate, or IT. I'm really good at the computer side of things, or, you know, fill in the blanks there. But that doesn't necessarily come with the business skills, the accounting, things like that. For that person who knows their subject really well, are there ways they can find that kind of help here in the state? Where do you point them to start building those budget building and business planning skills?
Yeah, I guess I would, you know, certainly check out local resources. Each community, different parts of the state have different resources available to them. And as I mentioned, the SBDC has offices throughout the state, so that's a good place to start. But also there's a lot of local entities and things that might be in your community that you should look into. There's also different types of loan programs that might be out there, some for startups. And, you know, there may be some grants available too.
We got an email from Carrie, who describes herself as a former hospitality and housing owner in central Wisconsin. Carrie emails, the COVID pandemic created a survival of the fittest in the land of business, where the monopolies are pitted against moms and pops, the latter of which is financially weaker. These band-aid attempts were just that, not enough for the mass of mom and pops, only to further seize the success of the monopoly organizations. There's always that concern, I think, about the playing field. Luke, did the pandemic make it worse, as Carrie says, worse for small businesses, especially those competing with bigger organizations?
I think probably in some cases it has, but I think, you know, more importantly probably is the ability of that small business to pivot. Different things happened during COVID. I mean, we all heard of restaurants that had to close their doors, and some of these restaurants said, well, we're going all to takeout. And so they were able to pivot and adjust to things. And I've got clients that were sit-down restaurants before the pandemic that have just stayed on that, you know, pivoted to takeout and stayed and continue with takeout only. So I think there's probably some truth to that, but I think a lot of it just depends on the business's ability to pivot and make changes and to adjust to what's happening right away. And typically the smaller business is more able to do that, more nimble to make those changes.
Now, for a business person, a small business owner who feels like they're kind of treading water right now with the challenges you just mentioned, they're just kind of getting by. what's a first step in making that pivot, in evaluating what are we doing, what could we do differently given these uncertainties?
Well, I think the first step, again, I would come back to is really understanding your financial situation, understanding what if you're offering multiple products, what products are making money, what are your margins on your product? In other words, what are you selling it for? What do you have to pay to produce it or to buy that product, and make sure you have enough margin there to make it go. And you know, sometimes you see that with employees now, especially in the restaurant world, with inflation on food costs and things, we're seeing that a lot of restaurants have not been able to keep up with the rising costs and adjusting their prices, their selling prices for food. And so their margins are shrinking. So they need to be aware of that and really to, you know, really plan ahead and keep thinking about those things and keep watching things. The critical success factors of your business, you have to monitor them all the time.
And in just our last less than a minute, what are you watching for next with all these different variables going on? What do you have your eye on the most as we head into a new year when it comes to small business?
Well, I think right now what we're seeing is the interest rates are really probably a major factor, because I know the Fed is adjusting interest rates to try to knock inflation down, and it's probably working some, because we are seeing a lot of clients that have maybe pulled back on projects because the interest rate is so much higher than it had been in the past few years. I think we also have to realize, though, that still interest rates at 6% is still a pretty good rate when you look back historically. I remember my first home rate was around 12%. So we're still at fairly historically low rates, but we're not used to these types of rates. So,
Luke, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Luke Kempin, director of UW-Eau Claire's Small Business Development Center, with us for a look at Wisconsin small businesses and how they are doing. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about an animal sanctuary.
Primate research has led to countless scientific breakthroughs. But when a monkey is no longer needed for research, what happens next can be an ethical quandary. In South Central Wisconsin, a team runs a sanctuary for monkeys as a way to say thank you for their contributions to science. Jana Rose Slice brings us the story.
There's a small animal sanctuary tucked away in a quiet rural area in Marquette County. Here, you'll find 9 monkeys living in habitats close to their natural environment.
That's actually Bella doing a warning call, saying stranger danger, there's visitors today. But she likes to let the other monkeys know what's going on.
That's Amy Kerwin, executive director and founder of Primates, Inc.
And then Jojo on the right, he's a green monkey. He's just 1 year old.
The monkeys living here were former research animals or pets. Kerwin used to work with 97 rhesus monkeys in a University of Wisconsin-Madison lab. She loved caring for them as they were used for biomedical research.
You know, some labs don't want your employees to grow close to the animals, but since the monkeys are so like us, it's almost inevitable. You're going to grow close to them, so why not help facilitate and give a chance so they can give back?
Kerwin has set out to do just that. When an animal is no longer needed for research, it has few options. It costs thousands of dollars for one monkey's retirement care.
It costs just hundreds of dollars to be able to euthanize a monkey to free up their cage or sell them to more research than you actually make money. So the motivation to retire is an ethical compromise.
After learning about the barriers monkeys face getting into retirement, especially in Wisconsin, Kerwin decided to make a change. She started Primates, Inc. so the retired monkeys can live their lives as close to their wild counterparts as possible. It's also a way to thank them for their contributions to science. Fallon Mullen also used to work with monkeys in a research lab and is now the animal care manager at Primates, Inc. She's responsible for the day-to-day care of the monkeys.
This is Mars. Just turned 16, like I said. He is a rhesus macaque male as well, also from the biomedical industry, and he's paired with Timon. who everyone calls Sweet Timon, because she's just so kind of timid and really, really sweet-natured.
Many of Primates Inc. residents have never lived in their natural environment. Staff maintain greenhouses, raised walkways, and indoor and outdoor spaces for the monkeys. Mullen says this encourages natural behaviors like foraging, grooming, and playing.
But we've never seen a monkey actually swim. They'll sit in the pool. The pools are, you know, like either like kiddie pools that you would imagine, or like turtle sandbox, you know, about that depth. So not real deep. But the monkeys in the past have, you know, like I said, just sat in them, waited in them.
But Mullen says that changed when a pair of surrendered pets showed up.
But Noah, who is a rhesus macaque male, he is paired with Maddie. We just gave them their pool this month, and he can be seen actually swimming. So he goes under the water and does several circles and will come up for air, and it's just so amazing to see, because he didn't learn this from the other monkeys here. So this was just like his natural instinct coming out, and also such a great story about why monkeys should have the opportunity for retirement. It's just so amazing.
Kerwin hopes to grow Primates Inc. to house 100 monkeys because she sees the impact retirement in a natural environment can have on former research animals.
Jana Roche Life brought us that story about an animal sanctuary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, take a trip to the movies at the theater or on your screen at home. Kate's guest shares holiday movie recommendations, great films for the season, and you can too. And you can get started right now. If there is a favorite holiday movie, past or present, or something you've actually seen that's out new this month maybe, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. It's Movie Talk tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Republicans say fertility treatments aren't at risk from a range of new state abortion restrictions, but recently leaked audio suggests anti-abortion groups have their sights on IVF and want to see tighter regulations on providers. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Illinois Democrat, says the treatment is essential and joins the show today at 6 on 1A+. Now let's set the scene. An eccentric rich guy shakes up the world with a big announcement at a press conference.
I'm just not the hero type, clearly, with this laundry list of character defects, all the mistakes I made, largely public. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark in the original Iron Man movie. That announcement ends the movie and begins one of the biggest pop culture franchises ever, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Spanning a few dozen-ish movies and counting, plus some TV series too, sort of, Marvel superheroes live in a shared universe and a developing plotline that's dominated pop culture, made tons of money, and influenced other creators. And our next guests say the Marvel Cinematic Universe is packed with political messages that reflect the culture of their time and can influence it in turn. They've edited a new book tracing some of those messages. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts about the political and social messages that you've seen in a superhero movie or show or a comic book? Or are you going to superhero stories to get away from all that stuff? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guests are the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Nicholas Carnes is a professor of public policy at Duke University. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And Lily J. Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Rob.
Lily, let's start with you. If we want to learn about our political world, why turn to pop culture?
I've long studied popular culture, and popular culture often reflects back the realities of our lived experiences in so many different kinds of messages and in so many different kinds of presentations and representations. And so while popular culture, be it televisual or cinematic or video games or music, are also forms of entertainment and capitalism, they also talk to us a lot about who we are and what we do.
Okay, Nick, why the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Well, I focus on just the sheer scope of it. I mean, we're up to 30 films, 9 Disney Plus shows, and, you know, films are regularly making close to or more than $1 billion at the box office. So part of the appeal of studying this sort of entertainment franchise is just the sheer number of people watching it and thinking about it. And as a political scientist, that's a site where I really want to know, okay, what are the messages? What are the political messages it's sending?
And Lily, is there something inherent in a superhero story? You talk about this, I think it was in the introduction the two of you wrote to the book, that there are big problems that only amazing individuals can save us from.
Yeah, I mean, superheroes occupy a space that is one that is generally not, quote, democratically, small d, democratically elected. So they operate usually outside of a governmental system, which is can be somewhat problematic. And then we look to them to solve problems that we ourselves cannot get ourselves to solve with their superhero capacities. And that perhaps gives us, unfortunately, the out of never being able to solve other problems that we face on the regular basis, because we always want superheroes to solve those problems.
And Nick, looking at the different pieces in your book, the different Marvel movies, if we're going and looking for one political message, we might be in trouble. There's so much variety here. You and the authors of pieces in your book, it seems like they found a pretty wide variety of messages, sometimes even conflicting with each other.
That's right. And that's why this volume is sort of drawing on more than 30 political scientists' expertise on a wide range of topics, because when you have so many films with so many different creative teams, there's actually a lot of variety. And there's no one sort of single message that I think is coming out of this cinematic franchise. So we really need it. I mean, when Lily and I sort of started working on this project, I think we realized really early on, it had to be a big team effort to even, you know, sort of scratch the surface at understanding of, you know, what's going on in this huge amount of cinema and pop culture text.
We're talking to political scientists Nicholas Carnes and Lily Gorin, co-editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see political or social messages coming through? Do you think they're on purpose or accidental? Do you like those messages when you're going to see that big Marvel blockbuster or the TV show? Or if you're reading the comics, the book doesn't go there, but you can. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jake joins us now in Appleton. Jake, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just want to say that I'll argue that I don't believe there's political messaging in this, simply because I don't believe political messaging is a big draw for movie and theater appreciation, or just people who enjoy cinema. And I'm sure we could look at older movies like The Wizard of Oz and things like A Lion King and probably find similarities to political messaging, simply because the last 5-6 years has been extremely deep in like exposure, like I more in my lifetime than I remember. So that's my comment on it.
Jake, thanks for the call. And Lily, maybe we're going to these movies for escapism. If there are political messages in there, they just kind of wash over us because we're there for the story of the special effects.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that we're not necessarily talking about a writing team or a directing or producing team that sits down and say, we want to communicate this particular right. message. But messages are communicated. And there are lots of different kinds of messages that are communicated about race, about gender, about sexuality, about power, about governmental structures, about the military. And so, again, it's not necessarily that there is a finely crafted message that is the narrative, but the narrative does communicate a variety of political messages.
Jake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to get into some for instances and check out the chapters each of you contributed to this book. Nick, let's start with yours. You tackled the U.S. government appears a lot in these movies and TV shows. You tackled, are they portrayed positively or negatively? How'd you do that briefly? What did you find?
So one of the things I was interested in when we first started thinking about the MCU and what sort of the subtle political messages might be is when the U.S. government is on screen, is it a good guy or a bad guy, right? So there's this idea that Lily referred to that, you know, superheroes kind of solve the problems that governments can't. It wouldn't be a very interesting movie if, you know, a villain showed up and, you know, Congress passed a law and solved it. That might not be what people are looking for when they want to go see a blockbuster. So then the question is, well, okay, so what is government's function here? Is it sort of a hapless, you know, we can't do anything and the heroes come and save us? Is it potentially an adversary? Is it corrupt? Is it, you know, working against the heroes? And so I worked with a couple of research assistants to actually code every single instance when the U.S. government is represented on screen in all the MCU films in phases 1 through 3. So the first 23, 24 films. And what we found is actually more often than not, government is on the side of the good guys. It's not helpless. It's not evil. More often than not, government is there and working with the heroes. So that's what we mean when we talk about the sort of subtle political messages that we find in these, you know, there's never sort of a scene where, you know, a hero saying, oh, government is good or government is bad. But in the background, we're seeing government operate. And I wanted to know, you know, what's the message people are taking away?
And then, Lily, you looked at the role of nostalgia in the Marvel Cinematic Universe versus, you know, the way it's used in the political world now. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, I was looking at the way that movies themselves are entities that are structured nostalgically. Your experience going to the movie often takes you to a different place that can make you yearn for a different time or experience. And so I was looking at the MCU broadly in terms of what is being presented in this way that would make somebody yearn for another time or a different construction of our current situation. And I found that there is a connection between both nationalism, particularly U.S. nationalism, and a kind of nostalgic yearning for heroics from times gone by. And, you know, Captain America is kind of obviously an embodiment of this because his life spans 100 years or more. But you also see this in some of the other franchises, like in WandaVision, where nostalgic sort of tempos are integrated into the entire series by presenting it as different sort of decades of sitcoms. And so you have a lot of woven into the MCU, a structural nostalgia. And I wanted to sort of think about that and understand that in terms of this whole cinematic universe. Is it just Captain America, or is there more than Captain America in terms of that sort of understanding?
We're talking about big screen superheroes and some of the political and social messages they may send, with the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about political messages, social messages that might show up in superhero pop culture, whether it's on the big screen or small screen or the small page? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lily Gorin and Nicholas Carnes, political scientist and editors of the new book called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you followed some or all of these movies and TV shows in that Marvel world? Do you see political themes and messages in any superhero stories, print or screen? Do you like those messages? Do they bother you? A little of both sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Waupun. Michael, hi.
Hi. Enjoying the conversation here. Many years ago, I was able to meet Stan Lee at a comic book convention. I brought my Silver Surfer comic, and he paused, and he looked at it, and he said, "Ah, Silver Surfer, he was always my favorite." And as a little fanboy, as a kid, that just made my day, that like my favorite character was Stan Lee's favorite character.
What is it about Silver Surfer that you and maybe Stan Lee appreciated?
Well, he's a character that sacrificed himself in order to save the planet Earth from the character Galactus. And then he became kind of a herald for him, just kind of searching the universe, looking for planets for him to devour. And it kind of expresses our own humanity and our own, maybe, you know, Galactus couldn't understand why he would do that.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Lily, this is kind of contrary to my point I brought up earlier. We're waiting for the superhero to save us. This is a case, this is a character who hasn't appeared in the Marvel Cinematic Universe yet, I don't think. But a normal person who sacrifices himself with a huge ethical decision. Do you see in some ways superheroes being an inspiration for individual action in the political or social world?
Oh, I would say so. And of course, you do have a number of the MCU superheroes who are not, in fact, gifted with superpowers. Both Iron Man and also Black Widow are straight up human beings. They don't have special powers. And of course, Iron Man is a man in a can. And so he designed it and it does all kinds of stuff. But he is, you know, he is just a human being like the rest of us. And so I do think that there is a dimension, particularly of this understanding of what a hero is and who a hero is. And a couple of our authors really dig at that and sort of put it in context of, you know, how we might each be able to be heroes in particular ways. And what is it that makes a hero? You know, superheroes have these particular qualities and capacities. But the idea of a hero has much longer legs in a lot of ways.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hope you still have that autograph. That's pretty cool. Nick, we've talked a lot about, I think, U.S. politics and your work looks at the U.S. government in the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. But and the two of you write about this in your introduction. These are movies where people are hoping to make money all over the world that can lead to some compromises. A location, for example, I think a Doctor Strange movie gets changed from Tibet to Nepal to not offend the Chinese government. How much does the global audience, you think, affect the messages, the choices we see?
Well, I just want to say first, I still have goosebumps from Michael's description of his interaction with Stan Lee.
That's
I'm
pretty cool.
A comic book fan myself and a fan of the genre. So I'm still reeling from that anecdote. I think that's a great example. So the moving Kamar-Taj, Doctor Strange's sort of trainings, where Doctor Strange is trained, moving that from Tibet, which it is in the comics, to Nepal, which it is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is a great example of Marvel Studios and Disney really trying to avoid political controversy. And, you know, our first caller said, you know, I don't see a lot of political messaging in here. I actually think that's not an accident. You know, Disney's trying to appeal to global audiences and to a broad audience here in the U.S., and so they're really trying to stay out of political fights. They you know, sometimes can't help themselves. You know, fans will pressure for, you know, Disney or Marvel Studios for more representation or for less representation. You know, they're going to be accused of being too woke or not progressive or not enough. And I think in this, you know, the sort of capitalist or the sort of market impulse that's driving, you know, a big corporation like Disney is always going to be avoid those controversies when you can. So I think you're going to see that not just internationally, but also in terms of the way they interact with domestic political debates.
Talking to Nick Carnes and Lily Gorin about the new book. They're co-editors of The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily, Nick just mentioned issues of representation. That occupies a good chunk of this book, different essays on how representation has changed over the years in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Can you talk about some of the things that the authors bring up?
Yeah, this is a really rich area of discussion in the book. All areas are excellent, but there were just a lot of different contributors who wanted to talk about different aspects of this question of representation. So there's questions of feminism that are explored in a number of places. There's questions of disability and trauma that is explored. There's this really fascinating chapter on how the Avengers are a kind of found family or built family. That was a really fascinating chapter when it first came across our desks and we started reading it. There are, of course, questions about masculinity, because that's so much of what is presented in symbolic ways throughout the MCU. There is a question of the MCU closet and who's still in it and sort of lack of representation in certain regards with regard to the LGBTQ+ community. So all of these different areas are sort of represented in different chapters. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion with regard to race and understanding a place like Wakanda, which is a kind of Afrofuturist paradise, if you will, and you know how that sort of stacks up against our understanding of the Black lived experience. So there's all kinds of stuff in there in terms of these many, many, many properties. And you know what they are communicating in terms of character development and narrative and symbols and our understanding of ourselves.
Nick, as a comics fan and a political scientist, I imagine you must bring this into the classroom sometimes. How do you talk to your students about how to read a text like a superhero movie and start to look for these kind of messages?
Well, so I sort of take a lot of cues from the, you know, scholars like Lily, who, you know, really have deep expertise on popular culture. I try to convey to students something that I learned from Lily, actually, which is to think about politics not just as elections, campaigns, debates, speeches, but to see politics as, you know, questions about power, representation, and how we live our lives. And once you sort of take that broader perspective on politics, you start to better, you know, see the politics that does exist in popular culture texts like the MCU. And you also better understand why people so often have real world political debates about what occurs in fictional, you know, storytelling. You know, why people will say, I don't like this character being depicted this way. It's because that's really a site where politics is happening, even in fiction, even in superhero stories. So I try to convey that to my students.
Just a few moments left. I'm going to put each of you on the spot and ask for a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie recommendation if somebody's going to see just one. Lily, you get to go first.
Thor Ragnarok.
Okay, easy. Quick line on why.
Because it's hysterically funny, and it really is an interesting exploration of, you know, sort of superheroics. And there are a variety of different sort of nods towards gender and race as well.
And Nick?
I'd have to go with Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 1 or 2.
Excellent. That is all the time we have. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, thanks again.
Been talking to Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University, and Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. They're the co-editors of the book we've been talking about. It's called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They both had a quick pick. I like that. No hemming and hawing. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out how a nationwide increase in overdose deaths is affecting Wisconsin and look at a community response that's trying to turn things around. Plus, Food Friday, Deb Perlman from Smitten Kitchen is back with us with some new classics. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.